This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
This is such an important interview. I'm here outside Cafe Palestina in North London and I'm interviewing the brilliant Stephen Kapos. He is a Holocaust survivor. He lived through the most horrific crime in human history and he's speaking out now about the genocide in Gaza. We're going to talk about his experiences of the Holocaust. We're going to talk about Israel and Zionism and we're going to talk about the here and now. I think he's got a lot of very, very important things to say, and I think we're all going to learn a lot. So, Stephen, huge honour to speak to you.
Same here. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Honour's all mine, honestly. Yeah. I just want to start by talking about your experiences. You were born in Budapest, capital of Hungary, 1937, really on the eve of, obviously, the cataclysm of World War II and the Holocaust. Just to start with, your memories and also what you know about your family. In the run-up to the, obviously the horrors of the Holocaust.
Well, Hungary had a history of anti-Semitism almost from the end of the First World War onwards. And for example, my father, because of racist laws of numerous clauses, as it was called, had to do some of his medical training in Prague, because he was barred in a Hungarian university. So we had an autocratic right-wing regime which fostered anti-Semitism, but not in a violent manner. And the situation got much worse during the Second World War, which reached Budapest and Hungary quite late in the war, in 1944. When the Germans lost faith in the Hungarian, hesitant Hungarian ruler Horthy, who started to have background negotiations about leaving the alliance with Hitler, and therefore they decided to invade Hungary, which happened in March 44, and that stemmed as a critical date for the Jewish population, because everything got very much worse. Eichmann came in with the Nazi forces, and he immediately set about deportations of Hungarian Jews from the countryside to begin with. At the early stages, the Jews of Budapest were not transported immediately, but only suffered a kind of preparatory stamping and concentration. We had to wear the yellow star. We had various restrictions introduced in stages, like weren't allowed to own a radio, for example, or use the public transport except in the last carriage, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so it was systematic humiliation and preparations for deportation, like from the countryside. From the countryside, it was very rapid. 400,000 people were very quickly transported to Auschwitz. And some extended members of my family, aunts and uncles and their kids, etc., fell into this transportation. And 15 of them died in Auschwitz. One or two came back, but of the younger ones, but most of them died. But in Budapest, in the meanwhile, there was this atmosphere of fear and foreboding and waiting for this to reach us as well. And this was the autumn of 44, And around that time, in October 44, I think, the Germans finally arrested even the their previous ally, Admiral Horthy, and the extreme fascists, the Arrow Cross Party, took power, and then everything got much more brutal in relation to the Jews. I was at that time taken up into one of the homes, and there were several, which were informally protected by the Red Cross, the Swiss Red Cross particularly, who had a very capable emissary organizing all this. And we were all on false papers and false names. Before that, we all had to wear the yellow star and live in specially designated yellow star marked houses. And so we had that experience before that. But once we were on false papers, we were meant to be refugees from the Eastern Front.
Right.
And orphan, war orphans, etc.
So that's supposedly, they would have presented it as these are pretended of German or kind of allied, Axis power children.
Yeah, Hungarian, because the Eastern Front approached Hungary from the direction of Ukraine and Romania. And there were waves of refugees, etc. So it's kind of confused the situation, made this pretense possible. Mind you, we were always under suspicion. The Arrow Cross very much suspected that this was all false, etc. And a number of times tried to raid these homes. And then we quickly requested the presence of the Swiss emissary, who was very brave and managed to kind of fight them off. He had some connections with the Hungarian Foreign Office, who said, yes, this is extraterritorial places, you cannot enter, and so on. But the Arrow Cross and the fascists never actually bought the story fully. However, the Germans did, and as opposed to the Hungarian fascists. And we, on the pretext that we were war orphans and refugees, at Christmas, when the Germans were already completely surrounded by the Soviet forces, invited us to celebrate Christmas together with them. And it was an invitation you couldn't refuse. And I have a very clear image of how that was, that we went into this hall where a white table, long white table was set, and we were seated between German soldiers, one Jewish boy, a German soldier, another Jewish boy.
And they just had no idea.
They had no idea. But the adults in charge of us were incredibly fearful, because the fear was that if one Jewish child asked for being taken to the loo, it would be discovered that we were Jewish.
Because I suppose that's the fear that adults, so you think about how to keep a pretense, but children can be unpredictable as well. You've got all these, how old was that? Because you would have been about seven?
I was seven, yeah.
7 years old. Seven. So these are little kids in this.
I remember, I have this kind of picture of this very formal arrangement along the white table, but also of the incredibly gloomy atmosphere. And the poor Wehrmacht soldiers, many of them were just conscripted, ordinary people, realized that they will never see their own family again. They were surrounded, and by that time the Soviet forces were overwhelmingly stronger, both in equipment and numbers. They knew that they were either going to fall in the last heroic stand, or captured and taken to the gulags, where the survival rate of German soldiers was something like 10% at best. So we were there as reminders of family life, which they will never have again.
I mean, for you as a child, such a young boy, I mean, there's such a, it must have been such a bewildering experience. I'm trying to work out, you know, when you're that age, it's difficult often to compute exactly what's happening. So what, I was wondering, you know, what were your kind of feelings and emotions at this time?
Yeah. I wonder about that because I don't remember any fear. And there were other situations which were even more dangerous. The front line reached us, there was house to house fighting, and we were virtually bombed out from our initial home and had to move at night across snow-covered back gardens, and we were shot at, I think by nearby Russian troops. And I remember bullets whistling past. And I still don't remember fear, you know.
Really? Wow.
It was just kind of one thing's happening after another, and I was like, if it was, I was a spectator to it.
Yeah.
But again, it was dreadful for the adults in charge of us. At one point, we were temporarily housed in a school building, which was made into a kind of wartime temporary hospital. Mm-hmm. And again, we camped down there. And my aunt, who was in charge of this group, overheard nurses saying, "Well, we don't believe these are genuine war refugees. I think they are Jews."
Wow.
And immediately we had to move on.
Wow.
And, excuse me. And so, again, you know, having to make a decision, where do you go? Mm. Where do you go? And
how do you remember when did you going to when you were, you know, safe basically, when
I remember again, my memories are like a picture album, you know, various bits. I remember us moving in a line across the snow covered back gardens from one place to another. Mm. In fact, we were escorted by the Wehrmacht German soldiers who still believed we were not Jews. And one or two of the younger boys were carried by German soldiers.
Wow, they just had no idea at all.
Well, I do remember this.
Yeah.
But, yes, and then we arrived at Otpesi. Now, the liberation moment was, again, a very clear picture. We were in a basement area of another building where we ended up. I think it was part of this archipelago of homes, you know. We were eventually told to go there, and we were in the shelter. And the entrance to the shelter was at a higher point. And suddenly, in the doorway, a Russian soldier appeared with his great Cossack hat and arms, you know, machine gun hanging on him and so on. And he looked around and said, "Any Germans?" And then he said, no, none here. All right, and he went. That was the moment of liberation.
Wow. More with a whimper than a bang.
Not everybody welcomed it, you know. We were a mixture down in that shelter. And I remember, again, this particular comment. I think he was a soldier with an Eastern ethnic background. And this person, who clearly wasn't well disposed towards the Russians, said, "Oh, even his eyes don't look right."
Wow. I mean, for a lot of people today, the Holocaust is such a huge crime, it feels quite hard to compute often. I mean, two-thirds of the European Jewish population exterminated in such a short period of time.
Yeah.
6 million, you were in the in the third that survived, so you're in a minority of Jews who survived this cataclysm.
Yeah.
A lot of people, I mean, before the war, Zionism was very, this isn't me explaining to you, this is just for the historical context for those watching and listening, but was such a controversial idea and movement amongst Jewish people. Yes. And you had other movements like the Bund in Poland on the left, who were very anti-Zionist. But after the war, after such an astonishing cry, it felt to many Jews that, look, we're never going to be saved. We suffered 2,000 years of persecution. We've had periodic terrible crimes, but now we've had this. And we need a homeland of our own.
Mm.
And that's why it appealed to people. And I'm just wondering what you think, just with that context, what your thoughts have in terms of Zionism and how it then manifested itself and what it became. Because I know you went to Israel and met with your relatives.
Yes. Well, first of all, the Central European background in relation to Zionism is a bit different from some of the East European countries, because Hungary, as part of the Austria-Hungarian Empire days, the Habsburgs had a policy of assimilation of the Jews. And consequently, this was taken up by the Jewish community in Hungary very, very much. For example, the Habsburgs propagated and advised the change of names of Jews from identifiable Germanic sounding, in Hungarian context, Jewish names to Hungarian names.
Right.
In order that the assimilation should be eased, because they realized the usefulness of the Hungarian middle class, etc., in transferring from feudalism to capitalism. So in Hungary, Zionism wasn't ever very strong, despite the fact that some of the Zionist leaders were Hungarian. But assimilation was the password, if you like. And we regarded the few Zionists in Hungary as somewhat freaky extremes. So that's a background. Post-Holocaust, this re-established itself. There wasn't a great move of Hungarian Jews to want to go to Palestine at all, or Israel rather, by then. And my extended family, quite a number of them did end up in Israel, but it was via Romania.
Right.
My family's background is Transylvanian, which is a huge chunk of territory, which is sometimes historically for 1,000 years was attached and part of, important part of Hungary, Hungarian kingdom, but after First World War gifted to Romania, then Hitler gifted a big chunk of it back to the Hungarians, his allies Horthy. And with the loss of the Hungarian regime in the Second World War, it was gifted back to Romania. It went backwards and forwards. Mm-hmm. And so a chunk of my family ended up in Romania through Transylvania, and some of them lived even in Romania proper, in Bucharest. And then during the Ceausescu regime, he had an arrangement with Israel of virtually selling Jews individually, so many thousands of dollars for each Jew he was allowed to go to Israel. Nowhere else were you allowed to go legally. And from Hungary, as opposed to Romania, nobody was allowed to go, either Israel or anywhere. Yeah. It was a kind of Iron Curtain closed area. So anyway, a section of my family did turn up in Israel through the good offices of Ceausescu, and I did visit them, and I discovered that even those members of the family who came back from Auschwitz because they were too young and put to work and they weren't immediately exterminated and somehow survived, came back after horrific experiences, and seeing their parents sent to the gas chamber and so on, I found even those people racist against the indigenous population, against the Palestinians. And I couldn't understand it, and I was completely shocked by it. And it wasn't only in my family, it was also, I thought it was all pervading Israel. There was an atmosphere of racism and militarism too, you know. You could see armed soldiers all over the place. This would be the middle 60s, before the Six-Day War. And I visited Jerusalem, which was then still divided. Mm-hmm. And again, I was shocked by the tour guides pointing towards the other side, making extremely racist comments. It was just all over the place. So the present attitudes are no surprise.
What are your thoughts about how so many people went through, frankly, just the most horrendous crimes, most unspeakable crime, you know, crimes that humans are capable of committing against each other during the Holocaust, and obviously had suffered in lots of different ways before that, as you spoke about anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
To have that experience of knowing what it's like to be racialized, to be oppressed and to suffer. And
humiliated.
And utterly humiliated, degraded.
Yeah.
And then to end up having the sorts of what you describe as racist attitudes when they meet at Israel.
I have no explanation. I just found it unbelievable and completely contrary to what you would expect. And it may be partially explained by the syndrome of an abuser. Abused could become an abuser, which you can see sometimes in family context, and it may be to some degree in a subconscious way true to a larger group of people and a nation. Not that it excuses it, but for example, this one particular cousin I can think of who survived Auschwitz, who survived because he was put to work in a warehouse sorting clothes.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
And one day sorted his parents' clothes. I can't imagine a greater trauma. And she herself, although traumatized and could not talk about her experiences, not even to her daughter, was quite clearly racist against the Palestinians. So was my aunt, with whom I stayed. And on one occasion we were watching the news, and there was a demonstration by Palestinians, and suddenly helicopter gunships appeared over them and shooting into the crowd. And probably rubber bullets, I hope. But anyway, they're shooting into the crowd. And I was completely shocked. And my aunt, who was a converted Christian on top of her Holocaust, very brave Holocaust experiences, said, "What's the problem? They are Arabs."
Wow.
You know, I can't make any comment. I was just flabbergasted. She was a converted Christian, a genuine one, Calvinist, which had to be kept quiet from her neighbours.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But that didn't stop her being one of the first supporters of Bibi Netanyahu.
Wow.
You know, an extreme nationalist at the same time as a Christian. It just didn't make sense.
Today, South Africa's taken Israel to the International Court of Justice for violations alleged of the Genocide Convention of 1948, which of course was established in the aftermath of the Holocaust.
Yes.
And that Genocide Convention has, five different crimes, one of which is genocide, the other is obviously complicity in genocide, it's public incitement of genocide. But there are five acts, and they're being, obviously, now that they're on trial for an alleged genocide, what's been described by the ICJ as a plausible genocide. Now, the Israeli state and their defenders say this is an outrageous libel. How dare you say that? What's your thoughts in terms of, you're someone who survived the genocide.
Yeah.
When they say this is not a genocide taking place, what's your thoughts about what's happening in Gaza?
Well, anybody who sees the news and can see the cruel and indiscriminate destruction cannot but agree that it is a genocide. I mean, after all, how can you argue any further after killing tens of thousands of kids, young children? I mean, end of argument, I think. And the pretexts provided, one that it is self-defense, doesn't wash, because we were way beyond that, and you don't self-defense doesn't go with dropping 2,000-pound bombs on living quarters. The other excuse is to liberate the hostages. Again, you don't liberate hostages by bombing. It will never work. If you want to liberate hostages, you negotiate.
Which is the only way we have had big hostages, because more hostages have been killed by Israeli fire than have been liberated by.
Not only that, but if Hamas are as evil as they're made out to be, what chance of cornering them and still expecting to find the hostages alive? If they are such evil people, they're never going to allow that. So the whole attitude, the whole claim that this is about saving hostages is a very transparent lie. It is genocide.
One of the
and ethnic cleansing.
I mean, one of the disturbing facets I found is, I mean, I interviewed Raz Sigal, who's an Israeli-American associate professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies. And he said to me that what's quite unique about this is intent is of the way that
it's
Israeli
declared.
Is very rare, actually. Yeah. So, you know, very striking examples of the Minister of Defence, Yoav Gallant, at the very start, saying we're going to cut off all the essentials of life because we're fighting human animals, or Benjamin Netanyahu invoking Amalek, in which God commands the Israelites to kill men, women, children, livestock, and all the rest. And just, because genocide always starts with words, doesn't it? It always starts with how people speak. So I just wondered about your thoughts.
Yes, it's a process.
Exactly.
It's a process. Because you first have to completely humiliate and dehumanize the subjects of genocide, which has happened systematically in the case of the Jews and the Holocaust. Absolutely. And I think it's very clear how it is repeating at the present time in Gaza. And also the use of starvation as a method, as a weapon, it cannot be in any way defended. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Israeli government's attitude of coping with that is quite simply denying it. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't work, because international bodies confirm that it's going on. Mm-hmm. And I find that in this connection, our own government's attitude is extremely dubious or wrong-headed. I think supplying arms and going along with and denying that the existence of this deliberate starvation, etc., was facilitating genocide, really.
I mean, that's would you say that our government is facilitating genocide?
I think, yes. But now, when they withdrew support from UNRWA, which was the only method, the best and on the large scale.
So people know that's the UN agency for Palestinian refugees, it's the main humanitarian agency in Gaza.
Yeah, which capable of distributing food and medicine, etc. To actually withdraw funds from that is a degree stepping further from facilitating to partnership with genocide, in my opinion.
Absolutely. And we've seen the claims made by the Israeli state about UNRWA have collapsed. They've refused to provide any evidence to support those allegations in a new report which has come out. In terms of people speaking out, I mean, you're speaking out right now, and you've been actually speaking out for before this happened. Yeah. Because before I speak, I want to talk about the protests currently happening.
Yeah.
And I'm also interested particularly in this incredibly courageous, often younger, but not exclusively, generation of Jewish people, particularly in the United States, speaking out. But your experience, you've spoken out before this current horror began. And I just want you to tell me a bit about that in the context of the Labour Party.
I was invited to, as a Holocaust survivor, and unfortunately there are fewer and fewer of us remaining who can still stand up and talk. Mm-hmm. And I was invited by a proscribed organisation, as it turns out, to speak about my experiences on Holocaust Memorial Day a year ago, January previous year. And I accepted because I felt that whoever asked me to speak about my experiences, I feel a duty to do so. And this organization, SLN, had trailed that I was going to be on the panel, which got to the Labour Party bureaucracy, and they wrote a letter a couple of days before I was due to speak to warn me that if I were to go ahead with that, I would be subject to disciplinary procedures. And I know what that means by that time. that means being expelled because the process is completely unjust. People never have a chance to be represented, and no appeal ever succeeds, etc. So I knew that that, in so many words, meant if you go ahead, you will be expelled. So as an immediate response, I resigned my membership and wrote a letter which justified it, explained that to me this was importing McCarthyism into the Labour Party and into the UK itself. So the Labour Party was performing a service of reviving McCarthyism, and I said that that would be condemned by history.
I mean, it is extraordinary. You know, I mean, I think history.
And I left.
Well, I mean, I think how history will look at all of this, I'd be fascinated to know, because in the present, it's almost indescribable, just the sheer level of horror, but the way the world's turned upside down, that those who speak out are the ones who are treated as the extremists. But in the case of the Labour Party, we'd all agree anti-Semitism is a grave evil to be combated. But the idea that protecting Jewish people means taking disciplinary action against Holocaust survivors, I think a lot of people look at that and think that is kind of unhinged.
Yes.
If I'm honest, just completely unhinged.
Yeah, I agree. So my letter was not kept quiet, you know, it was publicized all around, and that actually created quite a lot of interest and had a few interviews around that time about it with Middle East Eye and some other people.
Others who've spoken out, so for example, Stephen Glazer, the director of Zone of Interest, which is a brilliant film about the Holocaust. And he did this speech in which he said he spoke on behalf of him and two of his Jewish producers that we refute our Jewishness being used to justify these, you know, what's happening. And then his words were stripped out of context, as if he'd said, he refuted his Jewishness, which he never said. But I'm just interested in that, the way in particular, and we can see this in Germany, the figures show that disproportionately Jewish people are the people who've been arrested, deplatformed for speaking out. I do find that extraordinary that, you know, there's this systematic and deliberate attempt to disproportionately target Jewish people who speak out. And Stephen Glazer, you know, he suffered... Oh, sorry, Jonathan Glazer, you know, he suffered the, you know, terrible attacks. Another example, Yuval Abraham, an Israeli journalist who spoke at the Berlinale film festival. And then the non-Jewish mayor of Berlin denounced him and the others for anti-Semitism. I would go a bit mad just watching so many Jewish people being attacked in this way. Yeah. Do you not, as a Holocaust survivor, look at this and think this is just unbelievable?
Well, this is a disgusting weaponizing of the Holocaust experience and conflating the Israeli state and Zionism with simply being Jewish, and this is completely wrong, and it's a cynical and deliberate weaponizing. Big part of that is the definition that they brought about, the IHRA. Definition, which made any criticism of the Israeli state or support for Palestinians labeled as anti-Semitism. It's an outrageous distortion, and that's one of the reasons why I am taking part in the current demonstrations and become part of the Holocaust survivor and descendants group.
Because a group's been set up to bring people like yourself to speak out in this way.
Is to counter that terrible, damaging, evil conflation. That, in fact, a large number of Jews, particularly very often non-observant Jews, which are a large number, not everybody is organized around synagogues like the Board of Deputies claim, and we are against, totally against the use of the memory of the Holocaust and this conflation of Jewishness with Zionism. And protest against it, not in our name, and I think that that's a very important function of Jews who are against all this, and as regards the this false definition that is being used for this purpose. For these false anti-Semitism claims, it doesn't stand up legally. It's actually a very weak document. The Labour Party, who accuses people with anti-Semitism, never uses this definition in court because it's not good enough. And there have been much better definitions. If you need any definition. Even the Oxford English very brief definition is better and to the point. And since then, there have been a creation of an alternative definition called the Jerusalem Declaration, which is supported by large number of scholars, Jewish and mostly Jewish and other scholars, but it's being ignored because this is a political issue.
Finally, just want to ask you this. I wonder if you have a message for the protesters, particularly in the United States at the moment, who are being demonized. These are often student protesters. There's this new generation as well of a Jewish left, particularly younger Jewish Americans, organized around organizations such as If Not Now. But they're on campuses at the moment being attacked and arrested in Texas. Brutal, brutal scenes of brutal Texan police officers rounding up, not just students, but actually a bit, you know, roughing up journalists. For a lot of those young people, this will be quite a bewildering and quite intense experience. Yeah. And they're suddenly, you know, they're being denounced by the media, they're being denounced by politicians. Yeah. I just wondered, do you have a kind of message for them?
Yes, I do. I think what they are doing is extremely important because it saves the reputation of Jews, if you like, because of the evil conflation of Jewishness with the deeds of the Israeli state. The genocide and the extreme cruelty and humiliation that they practice on the Palestinians inevitably creates an increase of anti-Semitism, precisely because they conflate Jewishness with those actions. And to make a stand against that, like the young Jewish protesters doing in the States, is almost an essential move to save the reputation of Jews. And I think they're doing an extremely important job, and they should prevail and will ultimately win, I'm convinced.
Steve, it's a massive honour, honestly. It's been such an honour speaking to you.
Thank you.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.